Well, that, and that's what drew me into that whole world too of Scofield and Matheny and that, that fusion of the rock and, and Scofield had such a voice. It was like undeniably you hear him and it's like, that's Sco, you know? And he did a lot of cool records when I was young that, you know, like Go Go and all that stuff was coming out when I was young. So to me, it was super hip.
Welcome to episode 85 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. On this episode of the Bass Shed Podcast, I'm chatting with bassist Corey McCormick. Corey McCormick has worked with legends. Legends, I tell ya. This list includes, but is not limited to, Neil Young, Willie Nelson, and probably my favorite rock singer of all time, the one and only Mr. Chris Cornell. My chat with Corey is yet another Live from Lemur episode. I met Corey down at Lemur Music earlier this week. If you live in Southern California, I highly recommend stopping into Lemur Music in San Clemente. On September 3rd, Lemur will be hosting the first Music and Art Benefit. Lemur Music changed ownership about a year ago and relocated to San Clemente. The new owner, T is her name, is passionate about supporting organizations and nonprofits for those with special needs. So, on September 3rd, musicians and artists from the local community will be there supporting the cause through the donation of their time and talents to raise funds for the special needs organizations and other outreach programs. There will be more information at lemurmusic.com and on the Instagram page at lemurmusic shortly. So stay tuned for that. To all my friends that are teaching remote lessons, check out BlinkLesson.app. This is the most extensive software I'm aware of for teaching and managing an online lesson studio. You can visit thebassshed.com, click on the logo for Blink Lesson, sign up for an extended trial period. It is a total of a 30-day free trial. You have 1 month to check it out for free. BlinkLesson.app. All right, I'm going to assume most listeners of the podcast here are bass players. I think that's a fair guess. One thing I love about the modern bassist is that cats are writing and recording their own material. If that's the case, add Fine.com to your distribution platforms. Fine.com is a digital distribution platform that is owned and operated by musicians. It is free to sign up and upload your creative content, and real talk, Fine.com pays more than other digital distribution sites. You can listen to my talk with the owners of Fine on episode 76 of the Bass Shed Podcast. Head over to Fine.com and start making some money from your artistry. All right, as I mentioned, Corey McCormick is on the show. He has played with some of my favorite artists, not only Chris Cornell, but I really dig Neil Young and all the Americana singer-songwriters from that period. Corey has also performed with the legendary Willie Nelson. Willie Nelson. I mean, come on, it's Willie Nelson. Corey is currently touring with a fantastic talent of Lucas Nelson right now. That's Willie Nelson's son. Fantastic talent. So he's currently on the road with them. While we were down there, Lemur, Corey was having his Yamaha Silent Bass worked on. Luthier, Jason Brown, you can listen to my talk with him on episode 74 of the podcast, was doing some work on the Yamaha Silent Bass and worked some magic. Here's a pro tip that Jason is probably going to get a little pissed at me for sharing, but he used the Fishman Full Circle, right? So he bypassed the Yamaha pickup situation, put on the Fishman Full Circle, and all of a sudden, you got so much more detail out of the preamp. The pickup, Fishman Full Circle, is a lot more sensitive. So the preamp, you can get all this, you can control so much nuance. Great work on the bass. Jason Brown's a genius. So there was a slight little break in our conversation when Jason came in and started showing off the bass and what he had done to it. Then we went back to our talk. Corey was an absolute delight to have on the show. He was so open and he was so open about his personal life and things that had happened in his personal history that are not, you know, typically things that people like to broadcast, especially to, you know, someone you just met while you're recording a podcast. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful that Corey was so open about his personal life and his career. And it was an absolute great time talking with Corey McCormick. And so here it is. Here's my chat with touring bassist Corey McCormick. How about you? Where do you come from originally?
So we're born up north in Truckee, and we moved down to LA because that's where our families were all based. My parents kind of ended up in Truckee.
Okay.
Came down here around first grade.
Oh, wow.
Grew up in the Inland Empire.
Okay. So you've been down here a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm basically from LA.
Yeah.
I just don't like to say that. You don't need to.
That's fair. I feel like that's understandable. Like, it gives you that's a certain disposition when, like, you're an LA native versus living here your whole life. Yeah.
I am from
here,
place,
but I'm not one of you.
Right. Yeah. I'm from a place a little less tainted here. I'm just trying to hold on to whatever little bit of innocence I can.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to join us? Okay.
Okay. We can do that. Yeah, no
All
worries. Right. So where'd you go to school? What are the parameters of the Inland Empire? Is it like South Bay, but further east?
I would say like Pasadena, once you get east of Pasadena, you have started venturing into the...
Like Brea, Rancho, kind of all those places?
Yeah.
Okay.
Rancho Cucamonga, Pomona.
Okay. Downey.
Montclair, Ontario, Chino.
Okay.
Downey. I'm not sure how south it goes because it kind of LA County sneaks back in there.
At the bottom.
Like, I think. I don't know what Whittier is. Is that LA County?
Or, yeah. I don't know.
I'm not sure. It's basically San Bernardino County.
Okay.
It's like the we used to call it the 909, but now they changed all the area codes. Some people have 626 out there. But it used to just be the 909. That was the Inland Empire, the IO.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And I went to Montclair High School.
Okay.
Which is, in Montclair. I technically lived in Ontario and played in the band in school there. But I was a trumpet player.
And I think that's a normal. Have you noticed a lot of bass players used to play trumpet?
Or some horn instrument.
Yeah.
Very weird.
Primarily, I used to be a trumpet player too.
Yeah,
and it's like trumpet. And then like, no, I go to the back of the band. And that's.
Yeah.
Like, most bass players started on some kind of lead instrument like trumpet or guitar and then realized like, nope, not for me.
Yeah.
We're going the other direction.
I moved from trumpet to guitar. Like my senior year in high school, I played guitar in the jazz band.
Okay.
I was supposed to be the lead horn player. That was a hard discussion with the teacher, he wasn't really stoked.
So you were playing lead trumpet or trumpet two, which is the solo chair?
I was trumpet two my whole career in high school. And then my senior year, the lead trumpet had graduated.
Yeah.
And so he was going to bump me up to the lead.
Okay.
That was the plan.
Yeah.
But I had been really working on my jazz guitar chops and I wanted to start college as a guitar player. I didn't want to go in as a trumpet player. I was just kind of over the horn.
Yeah.
I didn't see a future.
Sure.
Like a longevity
type
of thing for what I wanted to do.
Right.
There's more options on guitar.
Right.
And I was just enthralled by, guys like Pat Metheny and John Scofield mostly.
Right.
And
so what year is this? Is this like late 90s, 2000s?
I graduated in 94.
Okay.
Kind of old.
Sorry.
So I started playing guitar in junior high, just randomly. My dad had a guitar laying around the house. And he said, "Here," I remember him saying, "Here's a chord chart. You want to learn? Figure it out."
All right.
So it was that type of thing. And I sat and learned chords and started learning songs by ear. I started working, I had money, so I started getting lessons from Ontario Music from this guy there, learning some jazz stuff, mainly trying to figure out how to read on guitar, because I could read really well on the horn.
Sure.
But something about this other linear thing and having so many options of the same note and like.
But then how did it work going from B flat to C? Because
that
trumpet,
wasn't
a
big deal.
Okay.
That didn't really affect me so much because it's still treble clef and.
Yeah.
You just go, okay, now I'm in, I don't have to transpose or transcribe any of that.
Right. Jason, come on in, bring the bass.
Yo, how are we feeling?
We're live. Come on in.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hey.
Don't be shy.
All right, this is the portion of the talk where Jason Brown walks in with the Yamaha Silent Bass, and it's probably like 25 minutes that we're just like hanging out, checking out the bass, playing with the amp, playing with the preamp on the bass, checking out the new pickup. It goes on, you know, like I said, for about 25 minutes. So I cut that part out because you can't really hear it in the background there. But now here's the rest of my talk with Corey McCormick, and we are now, you know, still in the gear mentality. So here we are picking up with gear talk.
I'm building a second pedal board as we speak for home.
Okay.
Because it's like kind of now the trend where all the gear is going to stay with the truck and,
yeah,
you know, not necessarily come to LA. And so I have bought another Noble last year, and I have a smaller Helix, and I haven't put it all on a board yet, but I got that new Justin Chandler wah that's fucking sick.
Oh, I don't know about it.
The Dunlop.
Okay. Really? You use wah a lot?
I like to use.
Yeah. you don't have to feel like self-conscious about the answer. I'm not trying to wah shame you. Like, you can be proud about the wah.
Yeah, no, I love the wah, man. Okay. I am not shy about it. You know, like, you know, some of the bass players that I was influenced by, I didn't even realize, because, you know, I didn't realize how much I was listening to bass players until I started playing bass. And that wasn't until I was 19 or 20.
Okay. But, so let's actually rewind. So you were in high school studying jazz guitar. You switched from trumpet to guitar. And now
it's not doing both, but I was focused on guitar. Yes. And then I went into college as a guitar player. I got into all the bands.
What college?
It's Citrus College.
Okay.
That was a great program. For me, I didn't have the money to go to university.
Sure.
And making that jump was just like, whoa, it just didn't make sense.
Yeah. Taking on all that debt.
They came to my high school and they were recruiting and they had this impressive big band and, you know, and the teachers were all, I remember, all dressed in suits, and I was just impressed, you know, and for a junior college, it was like, fuck, you know, $9 a unit or whatever, you know?
I remember getting to LA. And they said,
if you make the first band as a freshman, you get your tuition paid for, which they never did.
Really?
But I did make the band, and I did the full program on guitar. I did 2.5 years of the program. I did everything you could do. And then I just was kind of thinking about my career and how I was going to make money as a player, because I wanted to play. I didn't necessarily want to teach or write or any of that stuff. It wasn't what I wanted to do at the time. I wanted to play.
Was there any specific vision within that? Like, you wanted to perform and, you know, and be an active performing musician, but did you want to do like this genre or this particular thing, or be a studio guy, or was
there? I always felt like I would have been a studio guy doing like gigs in town.
Okay.
Type of thing.
But the main gig at the time, like, the vision was main thing, be a studio player who plays.
Yeah.
Who plays out when he chooses to.
Guitar players couldn't read that well. Yeah. You know, maybe that's still a thing. Yeah, that's still a thing. I don't know, but I could read well, and I'm set up pretty good for a studio thing. Like, I could play banjo, I could play acoustic guitar, I could do different styles,
do a bunch of aux stuff,
you know.
Yeah,
but I wasn't, and I also knew I wasn't gonna be John Scofield. Like, I wasn't gonna be like Miles Davis. I wasn't gonna be that thing. Maybe that was just I gave into that fear. I think, you know, anyone could be any of those people. I just didn't think I was gonna be. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just be the guy in the back. You know, I didn't really want to be the guy in the front. That wasn't what I wanted.
Yeah.
I never had that goal. I didn't realize you get women playing music until my later in my 20s. Like, I didn't know that was a thing. I just like playing music. Right, you know, seriously, I was a nerd in my bedroom figuring out Eddie Van Halen and Miles Davis. Like, that was what I was doing.
Okay. So actually, this is fascinating, because in that, between like The Rock and Miles, how much Mike Stern were you listening to?
A ton.
Yeah, because Mike Stern is
right in the middle.
That's him.
Well, and that's what drew me into that whole world too, of Scofield and Matheny and that fusion of The Rock and Scofield had such a voice. It was like undeniably very distinctive, you hear sound. Him and it's like, that's Sco, you know?
Yeah.
And he did a lot of cool records when I was young, that, you know, like Go Go and all that stuff was coming out when I was young. So to me, it was super hip. You know.
Did they do a second one? I remember there was talk of another one happening.
They did.
Okay.
They think they just called it just all their last names.
Okay.
The next one, I think. Not as good.
Mineski, Martin Wood, Schofield. Yeah. Like, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Just go not go-go number two.
Like this. Technically, really? Maybe it wasn't a go-go two. It was like a Mineski, Martin Wood plus Schofield record.
Okay.
But yeah, I was influenced by all that stuff, man. I really loved the fusion of music. I loved all kinds of different kinds of music. But
sure.
What I missed when I was playing guitar was I missed playing orchestra gigs. And that was another thing. When I played horn, I did a lot of that. Did a lot of classical music. I was always in like the honor bands and going up to the camps and doing all this stuff. Yeah. And I didn't have money. My parents weren't paying for that stuff. I look back and I didn't realize, but I was getting scholarships to do all this stuff. You know, but I was so young. I didn't really, it was just like these opportunities would come along. Like, ask my parents, can I go to camp? They're like, yeah, of course. Any reason for you to get the fuck out of the house? We don't have to pay for it. Perfect. Yeah, right, you know, but I wasn't thinking about any of that. When I look back, it's like all of it was on scholarships. And I used to go to the Arrow Bear music camp every year. And man, that really impacted my life. That's where I found out I want to be a player, you know?
Okay. What was it? What was it? What was the moment or the situation or the circumstance that kind of flipped that light switch on for you?
Seeing individuals that were older than me that were doing it.
Okay.
And seeing how good they were,
right,
and how much respect I had for them, just being in their presence, and how they were like gods. And
right. Then you're how old at this time?
In junior high.
Okay.
Grade school, junior
14, high. 14, 13.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are, you see these people and you realize like, oh, wow, they're making a living as a musician. It's,
I was gonna give up music going from sixth grade to junior high. I was done. I was getting bad grades in fifth and sixth grade. I was acting out. My family, my home life was terrible. And I was acting out because of it. And so I was in the principal's office. I was the class clown for 2 years. And I had this switch flip in the summer between sixth and seventh grade where I said, okay, you got to stop fucking around. You want to get out of your house. You got to fucking do good in school. And get a job.
Was this all self-generated or did some kind of parental or grandparent? No, this was all you.
Me.
Just kind of really came to terms with yourself. Yeah.
The whole summer, I'm getting a phone call from the band director at the junior high. I want you playing the band. I'm like, fuck that. I don't want to play music anymore.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a doctor.
Oh. Okay.
I want to go. I want to make money. I want to be like a part of society that's doing something good.
Drive a nice car, have a nice house.
Yeah.
Right. Be respected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he kept calling me. Finally, I just gave in like, okay, I'll play in the band, one band. And then this relationship with him grew and he got me into, well, he was pretty, I'm not religious anymore, but he was very Christian and he sucked me into this kind of religion world. Not a bad
is that
way.
Is that a Christian school out there or were you going to a
public school?
Okay.
He was like a musical director at this church and he invited me to the church. And then I was in the band and then we started a group on campus that would meet during lunchtime and I would play guitar for all the singing stuff. And, you know, he started me on my guitar journey really, and pushed me musically. He gave me this beautiful Yamaha horn, you know, that I still have to this day. I still play it. I started to think about the music thing a little differently, but it wasn't until I saw like when my high school teacher would bring in like Gary Pratt would come to school and I'd be like,
man, I just saw him on Monday. Oh, no, Thursday. What day is today? Today's Monday. Yeah. I saw him on Thursday out of the gym. Yeah. He sounded great.
Yeah.
Like he's still out doing the thing. He's crushing it.
He's the man.
Yeah.
And just seeing guys that were doing it, making a living, because my dad's thing was always like, you can't go to school, you know, what are you going to waste your time on that for? You're not going to make any money. And I was like, well, I think I could at least make enough to survive. And I was at the same time analyzing like his life, like my dad, you know, it was like miserable driving 2 hours in traffic to go to a job he hated. What was his industry?
Was he just a blue collar? Okay.
And he hated his, he didn't live life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always thought, man, I'd rather just like not kind of gave up the idea of like being rich or whatever. It was more like, I just want to like be happy.
Right.
You know,
I want something that's not what you're seeing.
Yeah. Yeah. What makes me happy is like playing music with other people, like-minded individuals.
Yeah. That
brings me incredible joy.
Right.
And so that was the motivation. And I think navigating and finally getting to the base was all just trying to find out the best, setting myself up the best way for success, I guess.
Okay.
At the time, there weren't a lot of bass players in LA.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like,
so there's too many.
So many. Yeah. And everybody's playing like crazy shit.
Yeah. There's way too many like ridiculous bass players. Yeah.
Back in the day, it wasn't really like
that. And no gigs.
So everybody needed a bass player. And, you know, I missed playing orchestral stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a year and I taught myself. I got the, what's the fucking?
Simandl.
I got Simandl and I spent a year. I stopped all the music stuff with guitar and I took that year to catch up on academic stuff.
Okay.
And they didn't have a bass teacher at the school. So I was literally teaching myself. And then they did this Christmas show and my instructor, one of the drummers there, he's like, you should come sit in the pit and watch Harvey Newmark. He's this incredible session guy from LA and older guy. And you know, you should come just sit behind him and watch him, you know, I was like, fuck yeah. And, he blew my mind. He's such a solid player with everything, you know, could play electric solid and his upright chops are insane. His bow, everything's super clean, you know, can read all that stuff and super nice guy. So I basically got him hired at the school. I begged him.
Okay.
Like, you guys need a teacher here. You don't have a bass teacher.
Yeah.
He wants to do it. Cause I remember talking to him, you know, how to make this happen. So they hired him on and I studied with him.
Oh, sick.
For the next year.
Okay.
And then auditioned to go to Long Beach State and got mm-hmm. into the program there, into the jazz band and the orchestra.
Okay.
And then finished my degree there.
Okay. Who was teaching bass there then?
I didn't study. They had a jazz guy that was like offsite. He's a player in town, spacing on his name. I literally took one lesson from him. I was focused more on the classical stuff. On the
classical thing? Okay.
Their jazz program at the time was trash.
Yeah.
They had two instructors on campus and one of them, much respect, amazing legend of a musician, but he just was having health issues. And it was like, you know, the class is a 2-hour class. He shows up an hour in, it takes him half an hour to set up.
No, geez.
You're not getting much class. You're wasting a lot of time.
Yeah. And
being like a blue collar dude, I was working and doing school. And so it was like time wasting wasn't a big thing. You know, I was like, sure. I can't. So I ended up dropping the jazz program and just focusing on the
classical. Okay.
And my teacher there wasn't the greatest. I continued to study with Harvey and a few people outside. It was more of the orchestra experience and all the small group stuff I got to do there. And all the you know, the harmony and theory classes were great. It was a good education. It was a good balance coming from Citrus, which was like commercial music.
Right.
And then to classical world.
Yeah. So then at what point did you pick up the electric bass?
So about 4 years into upright.
Okay.
There's a local band one of my friends was in and I was always a fan of. And he came to me and said, our bass player's quitting and we need a bass player. Do you want to play? So that was that.
You just go down to the music store, pick out cheap electric. And
so I had won a scholarship at Long Beach.
Okay.
And it was pretty decent payday, something like $5,000 or something.
Damn.
And I bought an electric, five string Ernie Ball.
Okay.
Stingray bass that I still have that I've customized since then. It's super sick.
What'd you do to it?
Well, it's funny. I have a story about the bass. The bass was, I was at the lowest point in my life. That was my only bass. I was working in a ton of bands. I just got divorced from my first wife and I was living with my friend. I didn't have a car. Like it was, dude, it was a gnarly. We should
swap stories. I've been there.
It was a gnarly scenario.
Yeah, I understand it.
And so the girl who gave me, one of my friends gave me a ride home from the gig that night.
Yeah.
And I, in her haste to use the restroom, I left my bass leaning against her car.
Oh, no.
And so when she left, all of a sudden I hear the knock at the door and she just like hands me the case and says, you know, it fell, or she said something. And yeah. I open up the, I mean, the body was completely cracked. It was fucked.
So you left the bass in the case leaning up against the car.
She drove off.
Exactly. I was about to just break down the forensics of it, but right. Because if it just falls, it's fine. Fast forward. No, she ran over it. Yeah.
She just didn't want to tell me that.
Of course.
She just handed to me and ran, you know? So it was a pretty low point. So anyways, the bass gets handed off to this random person, the friend of a friend who says he can fix it.
Is there anything salvageable? So the bass, the body's cracked. Is the neck cracked or is the neck still intact?
Neck's fine.
Okay.
He says he can fix the body. Okay. So I don't have money or any resources. So I'm just like, okay. The guy falls off the face of the earth. I don't know where my bass is. 2 years pass. I run into the guy at a party. Where's my bass, bro?
Yeah,
exactly. Oh, I don't know. I gave it to the guy to fix it and blah, 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 whatever.
He definitely sold it for
drug
money.
What the fuck's the guy's phone number? Gives me the guy's phone number. I called the dude. The guy tells me, yeah, I fixed it. It was great. I was using it on gigs and shit. I don't know. I left it in my kitchen and I don't know where it is. And I'm like, this is bullshit. He has my bass.
Yeah.
So I call the DJ in the band, this band that I joined, the first band, the Big Pill, it was called.
Okay.
8-piece funk band. And the DJ's, you know, kind of a from the ghetto, you know, little edgy. And I'm like, dude, this guy's got my bass. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
You know, he's telling me he doesn't have it. I know he has it. What's his number? Give him the phone number. 5 minutes later, dude calls me. Dude, I found your bass. Come get it. Went and got it. Didn't have to pay him. He wasn't
even
there.
What happened when you gave the DJ the number? What did the DJ do? Did you ask any questions? Okay. That's just
I asked.
You don't want to be an accomplice to whatever happened.
No,
right.
No.
That's hilarious, though.
I don't know what happened.
But you got your bass.
Hey, man, whatever. All I know is the dude called me and was like, come get your bass. And he didn't want to even see me. He left it on the porch.
Oh, damn.
That was how that went down. Never even met the dude. And the bass was fixed. It was playable. It was cosmetically needed some love. So years later, me and our percussion player in Lucas's band sanded her down and evened out some things and patched a little thing up and
nice, and
put a good stain on it and some new hardware. And now she's
nice. I like that. Yeah. I like that.
She's salvaged.
Yeah. I like that the bass has a story. I want to take all the finish off of a bass I have and like paint it and relic it myself because
it's fun. It's time consuming.
It seems like a fun process. And the bass came from a good friend of mine who's no longer a friend as a wedding gift for a wife I don't have either. Like I'm divorced. So like, but the bass is still there. So like the bass needs to be a part of that journey.
No doubt, man. You need like closure. You got
to. Yeah, it needs to be. It can't be the same bass. Like it's tied to too many weird things. It's a Lakeland.
It's a fun process to do that, you know?
I think so. I think it'd be fun.
I've done it to two basses.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. What was the other one you did it to?
The other one is this Gibson kind of Les Paul Junior shape bass that I got when I played with Chris Cornell. I started to work with Gibson a little bit. I had a rep in Canada and she would send me shit. And I was trying to get a Les Paul bass at the time. She couldn't find one for me. And she's like, I got this really cool other, you know, it's like a Les Paul Jr. Why don't you check it out? And it was rad. I used that bass a ton. I got to bring that out again, actually.
What years were you with Cornell?
His first
solo record that second one he did after Audio Slave?
It was right after he broke up with Audio Slave. He did that record.
With Billie Jean, that record?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't like that one as much as the first one. Euphoria Morning?
Yeah. Euphoria Morning is a classic.
I love that record. Yeah. Like I wrote a whole arrangement for this jazz quartet.
Carry On is like one of the many things he did later in his career that made me that old Arsenio Hall thing like makes you go.
Solid reference. I loved him though, man. He's like my favorite rock singer. Like,
no doubt.
He's my favorite. You know, I remember a friend of mine did a, he's a piano player, did a duo thing with him at the Troubadour. And I'm just like, dude, I remember texting him like, dude, you have like
Dennis.
Yeah, Dennis.
I'm like, dude, this is the best. I got him that gig.
Oh, really? Is that how it went down? I was trying to get Dennis on the podcast and he's like, you know, Dennis, Dennis isn't a talker. No. He's not. Dennis is a super quiet guy, but a sweetheart.
Amazing player.
Yeah. Ridiculous. But then he just pulls up like actually the text thread from Cornell where he's shit talking Eddie Vedder. Like, I'm like, dude, just come on and read that. Like, just read that. Or let's just get two people to reenact it. You know, like, well, somebody's Cornell. Like, that would be hilarious.
He showed that to Dennis?
No, Dennis showed it to me. Like, he pulled up his phone and it's a text thread from Chris Cornell where he's just talking shit about Eddie Vedder. Which I thought was hilarious.
That is hilarious.
Because Temple of the Dog was the shit, too. Like, I loved that band, too.
Yeah. And there's the whole thing when Chris died and Eddie didn't go to the funeral.
Really?
He won't even talk about it still.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was there like severe animosity there?
I don't know. I thought they were friends. You know,
I thought they kind of came up together and went their different ways, you know, just like their own separate careers.
I know that Eddie loved him.
Sure.
You know, Eddie looked up to him and Eddie gives him props for making him Eddie Vedder because of the hunger strike video. I mean, no one knew Eddie Vedder was until they did that. And that song was fucking huge. You know?
Yeah.
And it put Eddie on the map, made everyone go, who's that guy? You know?
Yeah.
And I saw them together at the Bridge School one year. You know, they actually did Hunger Strike together.
Okay.
And they were, Chris always said good things. He never talked shit about anybody in our presence.
That's cool.
He was pretty cool. You know, they say like, don't get too close to your idols, because he was definitely an idol of mine. And I think that I was pretty gun shy around him for the whole time. Pretty like starstruck, because
then that never kind of wore off. He never became a peer or an associate, or
not with me, because I think it's my fault, not his fault. I just was too shy, too just like.
Right. Yeah.
Stuck
in your head a little bit. Yeah, maybe
he was like,
I can see that.
He's like a Greek god, you know. It's like one of those things. It's like, I can't believe I'm standing next to you, type of thing, you know.
I feel like there's, with me, there'd be some people like that wouldn't impress me. Like, okay, you're so and so, fine, whatever. You know, let's just get through this. But then there would be some people like that where it would always still be so surreal.
So weird.
You know, that it's like, what the hell? I
think it's that thing for me. A lot of those guys, like Eddie's the same way. I've been around Eddie before. They were such a part of my life in my youth.
Right.
And it's weird. It's like I really kind of, they were like gods to me, you know? And so now like being around them, because I'm around Eddie quite a bit nowadays. He's around, we do shows and he's there. And I still am, you know, it's weird. It's like, and maybe it's me, it's a personality thing. Or Neil. I mean, we work with Neil Young and I'm still that way with Neil. I'm pretty gun shy, you know?
Really?
I mean, Neil's great. I love Neil, but he scares me a little bit, you know?
How long have you been in Neil's band?
We started playing with Neil in 2015.
Okay. Seven years.
Yeah. He just released another record. That's really cool. It's like a compilation of
was it Neil that just had a little spat with Spotify maybe about
six, eight months ago?
Right. There was some Rogan thing. And I remember loosely reading on it. What was that and how did it get resolved? Did it get resolved?
He pulled all his music off Spotify. He told Spotify it's either Joe Rogan or me.
Okay.
And then they bought
Rogan, so it's not going to be Rogan.
Yeah. So he pulled all his music off Spotify. It's all back on, obviously. Okay. But he was upset about Rogan.
Something to do with COVID or political stance or something, right? Yeah, they were feeling
that he was an anti-vaxxer and he was pushing and the initiative of don't get vaccinated.
I see.
Which to me is ridiculous. And I tell this to anybody. It's like, have you listened to the guy's show? Like, you have to listen to the show to have the opinion. You can't just listen to what the media tells you, you know?
Neil listen to the show?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't see how if you listen to the show, you could still have that opinion.
Right.
Because I've listened to his show.
I've checked it out a little bit.
I've listened to the specific episodes they're talking about, and he's not anti-vax. He's just asking questions.
Yeah.
And I think that's the scary part of this whole thing is with the vaccine. When the vaccine first came out, I was feeling like I had a lot of questions, and a lot of people I knew were like, shut the fuck up and take the vaccine, because they wanted to get back to life. Right.
Now, did you have questions about the vaccine that would prohibit you from getting the vaccine, or do you just had questions? Like, I still have questions about it. I got them both. I took all the shots, same, whatever. But I still don't really know. I still have questions about it all. You know, there's so many questions about it all. But I did it because, you know, I couldn't do gigs unless I was showing proof of that I need to work. That's, so,
I,
you know,
I like, was fine, basically forced into getting it. I wouldn't have if I didn't have.
Okay. To. I'm not necessarily anti or.
I'm not either. I think it should be your choice. Yeah. That's the whole point. I think so. So when you're going to make me take something that you're calling a vaccine, but doesn't act like a vaccine.
Yeah.
Because you can still catch it. You can still spread it. That doesn't make any sense. And hilarious. Then we're going to roll the vaccine out, but we're still going to keep you on lockdown. None of it made any sense to me.
Exactly.
And the fact that really intelligent people that I know, friends of mine, weren't asking questions and were just like, get the fucking vaccine already, you idiot, made me question it even more. It's like, what the hell is going on?
It was so divisive without enough factual evidence that showed the promised result. They didn't, you know, it's like they didn't say this, it does this, you get it, and then it did that.
Right.
There was still all this like nebulous information about it. And then it became so divisive. And then it became associated with a political stance or a social stance. And it had nothing to do with the vaccine anymore. And so that's when I started asking questions. Be like, all right, I'm not anti-vaccinations at all. No. But I don't run out and get every vaccination either.
Yeah.
I just want to know what's really going on here. You know,
I don't think anybody
had a solid baseline of information.
No, it was all about just getting things back to normal.
Yeah.
But it's like, okay, well, what if I take the vaccine and I have a fucking heart attack?
Yeah.
I don't want to die. You know, I'd rather catch the virus because I think I have a fighting chance.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. It's like most of the people that were dying were just like people that aren't me. Right. Like I'm not morbidly obese, or I don't have all health problems. Like those are the people that were dying, right?
Sure.
Older people, like, you know, I don't think I was at risk. So yeah, I'm really nervous about my kids because my son's about to be 5. And if they're going to, you know, make.
Now, this is interesting, actually, going into. So he's about to start kindergarten. So now you get booster shots when you go in. Is the COVID vaccination now part of.
It's not yet.
Okay.
But it could be.
Now, I don't remember. I mean, I remember getting booster shots going into high school, and it's something you just had to do in Arizona to go to public school. I don't think we had a choice.
You don't.
But that would be a way to grandfather in the everybody has to get the vaccine for COVID is start it with that new generation.
It will eventually be a part of the mandatory vaccines that probably are required to go to school in this country. Yeah. I'm sure of it.
Absolutely.
But I worry because my son has allergies and certain things, and you know, there are documented cases of the vaccine causing problems. And like the last fucking thing I want is to say, oh, I'm going to give you this thing to protect you. And then it's going to make you sick.
Yeah.
And
then it backfires somehow.
It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
I'd rather just let you catch the fuck. I mean, we already all had it. He was fine. He was sick for a day. He didn't even have a symptom other than the fever. And he just was tired.
Yeah.
You know?
I think when I had it, that's about it. Just kind of like wiped out and had a fever. And it was same. It was gnarly, like 6 hours of like super intense discomfort. And then I'm all right, sleep it off. Next day was fine.
Yeah. I mean, I was vaccinated. So yeah. I think that helps. But he's not. And he got through it. They say little kids are like almost immune to it.
That's what I've heard. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a strange world we're living in.
It is. It is. I don't know how we got from Cornell to that, but
we did. I'm not sure either.
But that's completely transition. Relevant. I mean, when did you pick back up touring? When did the tours open back up for you again? And how did you see COVID and all this vaccination stuff in different places in America and the world respond to it on your tours?
Well, it's funny because before we started touring, you know, our manager also manages Bob Dylan and Paul Simon.
Okay.
And he, you know, I hadn't got the vaccine yet. And I was like asking him, like, is this going to be a mandatory thing to get back to work? Or do I have to do this? And he's, I remember him looking at me and going, you think I'm going to ask Bob Dylan to get a fucking vaccine? But you know what ended up happening? Bob Dylan had to get a fucking vaccine.
Did they do it?
Yeah. Everyone has to do it.
Sure.
If you want to work.
Right.
There's no way around it.
Right.
So that to me was funny because I knew when he told me, oh, you won't have to do it. I knew. I was like, yeah, right. It's coming.
Yeah.
You know, it's coming. I'm going to have to fucking put this thing in my body. I already know it. And then the tour, we had a bunch of stuff that went away, obviously. And then the tour we did, our comeback tour was a crazy long 3-month grinder.
Okay.
And that was in the fall of last year.
Okay.
Really strict COVID protocols, you know, everyone masked up except for when we did the show, obviously.
Yeah.
Some of the crowds, there was mandatory masks. In some of the shows, which is really weird.
Were they still trying to maintain like every other seat and keep some distance between the crowd? That's got to suck.
Yeah. The first tour back was really weird.
Yeah.
The only thing I liked about it was the backstage hang went completely away.
Yeah.
Which is great for me in my old age.
You don't like the hang?
I mean, I like the hang, but the hang in the Lucas Nelson world used to be just too much for me. It's just like,
okay. You know, how old's Lucas?
He's 12 years younger than me.
Okay.
You know, 31 now, 32.
So he's still got some party. When I joined
the band, that was 11 years ago.
Yeah.
12 years ago. So he was a kid.
Yeah.
And from gate, it was, you know, we were in an RV when I started with him, and it was after every show, it was a party in the RV.
Yeah.
And then after we got the bus, it was a crazy party in the bus after, and craziness all the time. All the time, people on the bus.
It's exhausting.
And I'm not that social.
Yeah.
I need like quiet. It's hard for me to like focus and be productive in chaos.
Of course.
I need to have
a controlled environment. Yeah.
So, the COVID stuff, the backstage stuff, it was like, no one's allowed on the bus anymore.
Yeah. Killing.
I was secretly like doing fucking somersaults. You know, no one's allowed in the backstage. And then we set the rule of 30 minutes before the show, no one allowed, you know, like nobody, it's just the band. Because it used to be gnarly, like before we go on and everyone's just like people on the bus, crammed in the bus.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not getting a warm up in. I'm not doing it. Now it's very, I love it because I like warming up. I like stretching.
Sure.
I like doing that before and after. I like to eat after, you know, I like, and before the protocols, it's like, you know, for a show, I'm not getting nothing done.
Right.
Party on the bus.
They just party straight to the gig.
And then back after to the show, party. It's like, I'm not eating food. I'm not recouping anything in my body. I'm drinking beer and fucking smoke, you know, hanging out.
Yeah.
Which is cool. I'm not judging, but for longevity now, as I'm older than all the guys in the band.
Okay.
And I have two young children and I'm thinking more about, you know, the long game now.
Yeah, of course.
I used to party, but, you know, I like stopped drinking when my kids came and, you know, I've started sneaking a little bit in here and there now. But
yeah,
for me, it just needed to go away. I was healthier that way.
Was that easier for you to stop, or was it kind of a?
It was easy. The hardest part was cigarettes.
Yeah,
I smoked cigarettes for 15 years, and my wife smoked. And as soon as she got pregnant, she stopped. It took me a little longer. I eventually did, but that was harder than the booze.
Sure. Yeah.
I've never really liked drinking.
Okay.
I smoked weed. I started smoking weed right after high school. And I didn't drink until I was 25, really. I didn't start drinking until I was in like a band where we were playing out all the time.
So it's just like the social thing, like the community, like everybody's doing it, like fine, I'll have a beer. I'm
shy. And so, you know, you drink, you get a little loose.
Yeah, you get a little looser.
Right? Talk to people, you know, cigarettes and drinking. It's just like social.
Yeah,
and, absolutely. But then, you know, it gets taken out of control because you're on tour. And next thing you know, I'm not getting shit done because I'm drinking every night, sleeping all day right, long,
right,
you know,
right to the gig. Yeah.
And that was just not productive, especially with kids. And I remember, again, it all comes back to my childhood. My dad was an alcoholic and he was either drunk or hungover, and he wasn't very cool ever. If he was drunk, he was like a completely different monster of a person. He didn't get happy. Luckily, I'm a happy drunk, but I'm not a happy hungover.
Right. No, I don't think anybody
is. And that's really, you know, I started to realize, like, no wonder my dad just always in a bad mood, seemed like, you know? And like, I don't really want to do that to my kids. So maybe I should.
How are you and your dad now? Do you guys ever kind of make amends as an adult? And
I mean, he's gone now.
Right.
He died pretty early.
That's right. You said that.
And
no. Was it alcohol related?
No.
Okay.
He took his own life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I think that was depression.
Sure.
Mixed with the news of a heart condition that he had gotten.
Oh, wow. That's a lot to bear. Yeah. If he already had like a pre-existing depression or prone to some clinical depression.
He was not a happy guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he never was. And I was surprised when I heard the news, only because I honestly didn't think he had the balls to actually do something like that.
Sure.
That's a pretty major decision to make. But it made sense. I mean, he was clinically depressed, and you know, his relationships with his kids were not great, and not great with my mom. And, you know,
were they still together at the time?
They were, but
it
was never good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never.
But this kind of like being around this environment almost inspired you to go the completely opposite way as a father and with your own life.
It did. That's why I went to the church thing, like junior high, when it became a thing, it presented itself to me. I went full into it because I didn't want to be like, drugs and alcohol were bad to me.
Right.
Because I was watching my parents party.
Sure.
And where a lot of kids might just go, oh, I want to do that too. You know, yeah. I was like, that's not cool.
Right.
And so the church was great for me up to a certain point. Then I kind of saw what else is going on, and you know, it's flawed just like everything else.
Sure.
And that's not like, you don't have to go to church to be a good person and to be spiritual. And I started learning more about the universe, you know, going to college and all that stuff.
You're just becoming a young adult and getting more exposure to different ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I still think that, you know, the idea behind Christianity is you learn about Jesus because you are supposed to act like he did. And nobody does that in church, or it's rare.
that's a fascinating conversation, which is the institutionalized nature of church. And I think there can be parallels made to the institutionalized nature of anything.
Sure.
As soon as it's institutionalized and they need to bring money in for the institution to exist,
corruption.
Then you're dealing with humans, not just the tenets of, or the ethos of, the belief system. You know, you're not just dealing with faith and a higher power and Jesus and the Savior. Now you're dealing with, well, we still got to turn the lights on.
Yeah.
We still have to do this. There's salaries associated with this.
Yeah.
And people are in places and positions of power to
manipulate.
And that's easily, the congregation walks in and they're so receptive to what these leaders say. It's a tall order for the leaders to have integrity. And, you know,
I had some real bad instances with pastors. You know, I was dating the pastor's daughter in high school.
Okay.
And he fucking hated me because I wasn't Mexican.
Really?
And it's like, I don't get, when you're up there preaching this thing that it's not that.
Was the whole church Latin? Okay.
Living this whole life based off of these rules.
Right.
But you don't like me because I'm not Mexican.
Right, but you're just gonna be like straight up racist.
I was a good kid, you know. I had good grades, played sports in band, you know, and that was the first thing. And then the last church gig I ever had, this was after or right at the end of college. I was playing this church gig, and I just I got disgusted, man. The fucking guy, the preacher, is just all about getting people to put money in the basket. That was his whole sermon was all about that. Mm-hmm. He's manipulating these old people that don't have money into giving all their money to him. And I decided I'm never doing a church gig again because I don't believe in the church. I'm only here because I need a gig. And I don't want to take money from these people getting hornswoggled by this.
Right. If this is how they're getting financed, you know, and then they're hiring you, it's all
dirty.
It's all connected. Right.
You know?
Right. What kind of church was that?
Like a Christian.
Just normal Christian non-denominational thing?
Yeah.
Huh. That's sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Weird. Yeah. It was a weird one, too, because it started the church. When I started playing with them, they would meet in a conference room of a hotel. And then they started leased, I don't know, some kind of industrial space in this weird part of town. And they started building a church inside this industrial space. It felt very culty and weird.
Seems a little culty.
I was happy the day I quit that. Even though it was a good money, brought in a lot of dough, but you know.
Right.
Just didn't feel right.
Yeah, no, don't be around it if it's just bad vibes. Like there's always another gig, you know. Actually, Dennis told me that. I remember getting a call to do this gig one time and I was on the fence about it and whatever. So I called Dennis for some advice. And that was the best thing. Some of the best advice I ever got. It's like, man, there's always another gig.
Yeah.
Like this isn't, that one thing is not going to make or break a career. Like,
but sometimes you feel that way. When I was young, you know, I never said no. It was like I said yes to everything.
Yeah.
You never know what's going to come out of some
gig.
Yeah, and I did the same. It worked out for me.
Yeah.
Really, all the gigs I got were all word of mouth, you know?
How did that process start? So you join this band, you pick up the electric bass, and you're just a band guy with this orchestral training. You can read, you know, you have an academic knowledge of music, but now you're a rock band guy playing electric bass. How did your career navigate from that point on?
So I started, Big Pill started to build in popularity, and we had we were a band, and then we did this jam session on Mondays at this place called McMurphy's in the basement. And it was a jazz. It was just me, the drummer, and a guitar player. And everyone would come to the jam. And I met so many people doing that gig. So from that gig, I started getting a lot of jazz calls.
Okay.
And I was doing a lot of jazz gigs. And then from playing in the Big Pill, I started getting calls to play in people's bands. So I was in, you know, I was in this dude's band, this other dude's band. And then I started playing with this guy, Hoffa Moreira. He's a Brazilian guitarist. And at the time he was playing with Christina Aguilera and Pink. And he was like the new hot shit guitar player guy.
Yeah.
And around the same time I had the opportunity to do the Warped Tour. We had this thing, we put a band, it's a long story, but we did the whole Warped Tour in 99. I was hanging
with the Big Pill.
We put a band together at this was the year I left Citrus College. Kevin Lyman, who started the Warped Tour, is good friends with one of our instructors, and Kevin came to our instructor and said swing was a big thing at that time. And he's like, we don't have any swing bands on the tour, so I had this idea of you putting together a student band. And you do old punk rock songs in swing style, and I'll put you in a tent, and you get a bus, and you come on tour and bring the kids get a tour experience.
Yeah, yeah.
So we put this band together. I did most of the, I was stoked, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that gave me the like, I was hanging out with the Black Eyed Peas every day. Like, they were like the shit. They had the full band then. They were doing all the dance shit. It was like a real show. It wasn't the candy stuff. No offense. But what they do now is not what made me fall in love with them.
Was Dre playing with them then? Bowman? No? Okay.
What is it, bass player?
Yeah, he's
a bass player. No, it was this dude, Mike, white kid.
Okay.
He's like an accountant or something now. But,
he made all his money with the peas and then just went and invested it and got out of the game. Good for him.
He was good. And you know, I made friends with them and hanging out on their bus. And that gave me the bug. It was like, what is this? You get to just go a different city every day. People, because, you know, they're the Black Eyed Peas. So they're like getting like free shit gear, yeah, clothes, all kinds of
anything.
Stuff. I'm like, man, I want that. That looks like,
yeah, that fun. Looks like fun. Yeah. Yeah. Sign me up.
So my mind started going towards that. I started doing auditions for Barry Squire.
Mm-hmm.
I got a few in town thing. Like I was getting paid to rehearse with this artist for a long time. We only did a couple shows, but it was like a year and a half. They're paying me every month. Just rehearse twice a week.
Right.
It's a great gig. And I got a couple other things, a reggae thing, a couple things. And that's how I got the Cornell thing was I was in rehearsal with Hoffa.
Okay.
They called Hoffa. They wanted him to audition for Chris. They were giving him the gig.
Yeah.
And he asked if I could come. I wasn't going to get the call. I was on like the B list. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an A list call. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So he said, yeah, I know Corey, bring him along. And that's how I got the gig.
Killing. Great.
The Japan thing happened through me. The drummer that played with the Japanese artist saw me play at some random club. And when they needed a bass player to do the record, they recorded the record here in LA. He suggested me and they called me. And after doing the record, like, you want to go to Japan?
Sure.
And I've been back four times since.
Yeah.
Playing Budokan every time and these huge shows and, you know, and made lifelong friends over there. And
do you go back? I mean, since your wife is Japanese, do you go back just because she's probably still got family there?
Yeah. I just got back. We were there for 6 weeks. Oh, wow. They're actually still there for another month. Cause we just, her family hadn't met our 2-year-old. He was born during the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had a trip planned, but then they closed the borders. So we didn't go. And then it just all worked out where I had a bunch of time off.
Cool.
So we went over and, I hope to play there again with Koshi. I don't know if it'll happen ever again. Hopefully, we're still friends. Just a matter of what he wants to do.
Yeah.
He's in a big band there. It's called Bees.
Bees? Like B'S or B-E-E?
B'Z.
Okay.
And they're like the Rolling Stones of Asia. It's
really
Koshi's Mick Jagger and then Tok is Keith. It's
okay.
Like, that's their thing. Like I think Koshi.
Do they do Stones tunes?
No.
Okay. But it's that vibe?
Yeah.
That blues based rock thing.
Yeah. And it's a little more poppy than the Stones, you know, it's more Asian, I guess.
Yeah.
But, and then Koshi does his solo tours and that's what I would do, his solo stuff. And he changes his band all the time for the solo stuff. I've just been a common denominator for the last four, except for the very last one, he used a whole different band. I didn't do it last time. So thinking maybe I don't know, he could call me again, but.
Does he use guys from over there to make it cheaper?
Mainly Westerners.
Really?
It's a draw, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
For them, it's like a novelty thing.
Right. You guys are, I mean, Americans and white people are more exotic over there. Right.
Yeah. We're worth interesting. More.
Really?
It's interesting because the Bees had a band for 20 plus years. They're all Western guys.
Okay.
And the drummer is the friend of mine is the drummer in the Bees, but they recently let that whole band go.
Huh.
And they hired a new batch of Western people, younger. They like brought in a younger crowd. And then COVID hit. And so they couldn't bring everyone over. So now they have a Japanese band. And I don't know what's going to happen
in the
future.
So how many groups are you doing right now? You're doing Luke. You're doing Neil. Who else do you have? Your own group?
I have my own thing, Organa. Yeah.
Check that out. It's kind of a blues roots funk.
Yeah.
Super cool.
Yeah. That was an opportunity for me to get my production skills up.
Did you produce that?
Yeah, it's all
okay.
Mixed and produced. I have a guy that helps me mix, but I learned a ton like in the last 2 years
about I've recently learned how drastically different just the mix process is. Like I was aware that it was another portion of the record making thing, but just how uniquely different it is, different monitors, different placement. Like it's a whole mix guys are mix guys, you know, mix guys don't produce, mix guys are mix guys. I've just like started learning a lot about how how different that is.
Then which side? The mastering.
Right, which is a whole other guy. Thing,
yeah.
Yeah. Which one of the three, like producer, mixer, master, which one is your favorite?
Producing.
Because you like the creative input and the creative process?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love working with artists and helping them get their vision
okay.
to be what they want.
Yeah.
And, I love arranging songs and, orchestrating or adding backgrounds, that kind of stuff. Like, just being, that's the creative part of it.
Yeah.
That I feel like I'm really good at.
Cool.
I'm not like a writer, I write. I don't consider myself like, I'm a songwriter,
Right. Because you don't deal with lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a whole lot of things. Lyricists. That's a special talent.
It is. But yeah. I think you can nurture it and grow that talent, but I'm just not that interested in words.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I guess that's why jazz was always my number one thing. Cause I think it was like maybe the way I grew up where words were always said and the actions never occurred. And so words,
that's fascinating.
Words are not valuable.
You realize the futility of it.
I get more emotional. I get more emotion out of instrumental music than I ever will out of any kind of lyrics.
What are some of those records for you? Like those records where, you can revisit it, instrumental records that are always going to kind of take you to this place emotionally. Like you'll always be able to connect with them.
Yeah. Well,
whether it's jazz or classical or whatever.
Maybe. There's some stuff from my youth that, I guess, there is a lyric record, Rhythm of the Saints, Paul Simon.
Yeah.
That record's, if I was
is to pick just a before lyric, or after Graceland?
After.
Yeah.
If I were to pick a record with lyrics, it would be that one.
Okay.
That one really has an emotional attachment. I lived and breathed that record when it came out and it helped me through a lot of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Musically, there's a ton of shit, jazz makes me feel, especially like beautiful ballads or, this like Miles Smiles. What's the song of Miles Smiles? Forget the name of the song.
I haven't listened to that record in a long time.
But it's
great just, record, though.
I mean, I get the chills. It's like, evokes so much imagery and feeling, and.
Yeah, you're just the mood of it all.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah,
it's funny because having this kind of that you spoke about this home life situation growing up, it seems like I know. As primarily a jazz musician, singer-songwriters have helped me through therapy moments in my life because it feels like someone else understands. When they tell a story that relates to mine, I feel like someone else understands and then mine's validated. So it's actually a little bit opposite that songwriters were the ones that were more therapeutic.
Makes because sense.
I needed kind of the validation of, Or maybe I needed the feeling defined somehow by words, because it was so nebulous in my mind and just kind of in my soul spirit that it's just I was feeling this thing I couldn't make sense of, especially when I was going through my divorce, that I needed words to add some kind of structure to it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it was just this emotional anarchy that was all over the place. And so the songwriters, it's interesting. I just always think it's fascinating, like how and why people gravitate towards the things that they do. And for me, I think in reflecting on that, it was because I needed to be defined somehow because mine was too all over the place. But then what you're speaking about is, words don't mean anything, and who cares?
It
kind of devalues the word.
I think it was also, I wasn't ready to feel those feelings maybe because I now get more affected by hearing words and it actually not even in music. Like there's like poetry and like writings that I've been coming across doing a lot of reading about being a father and how to raise boys and all this stuff. And so like these kind of things come up and they man, they really hammer me. You know, I'll just break down fucking crying just reading this passage about the way maybe a father regrets treating his son or something. You know what I mean? Because I have those moments of like, damn, maybe I shouldn't have been so hard on him or whatever that is, you know? And I also think that I am emotionally more open now than I ever have been, you know? Because as a kid, you know, especially as a man, this is a problem in our society. We're not allowed to feel the emotions. And I was a sensitive. And if
that's role modeled to you from, you know, a father or whoever the male presence growing up is, if it's role modeled to be emotionally detached, you know, then you're just going to duplicate that.
Yeah. Like my dad did not understand me.
Yeah.
My dad thought I was homosexual.
Did you have siblings?
Because I was sensitive. So right, I was gay. You know what I mean? Because that's just the world he came from.
Right.
But I was just sensitive.
Yeah.
You know,
that's fine.
And I had to like walk that sensitivity or hide that sensitivity.
What was the outlet for? Huh? What was the outlet for? Like growing up and like, let's pick any kind of arbitrary time. Let's say 12 years old. You're starting, you know, you're becoming, you're getting into teenage years. You know, you're starting to feel things. Puberty's probably about to start happening. Okay. Things are going on inside of you. 12, 13 years old. You're starting to feel things. You're a sensitive guy. It's not responding well with your father. Where do you go to be emotional?
I didn't. I became an asshole.
Okay.
I treated people like I was like.
Is that because that's what you saw him do?
I think so. I think it was. Yeah, it's the way. Like my dad would make fun of me and say really hurtful things to me, and then be like, "Oh, it's just because I love you. I'm just joking." You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And so, like, that's how I thought. That's what I thought love was. Love so, like, was I treated all my friends like shit and always making fun of people. Like, that was my defense mechanism. And I did that all the way through until very recently, I think, you know, like I've just realized, you know, through the pandemic and a lot of time alone, you know, or off and having time to like, just be like thinking about shit. You know, I realized a lot of stuff and realized how damaged I am, still am. And I never really dealt with that shit, you know? And,
it seems like you're very aware of it though. So like there's a strong awareness, and I mean, we haven't met before today. You're very open to talk about it. So you know, there's the book. So there's it's not clearly something that you're hiding or that you're unaware of. Like, I think that those are major steps in dealing with anything. You know, like just sometimes just the awareness just newer, can help you. You know,
being aware, and maybe too aware. Like I'm always paranoid. Like I'm always asking my wife, are you okay? Everything okay? Yeah, you know what I mean? Cause, sometimes I don't know that I'm being a dick and I'm being a dick. Yeah. You know, it's like a natural, my mom is very rough the way she talks. Okay. You know, my dad was rough and that's the way I grew up. And that's how I learned how to show love. And
Does your wife ever say, you're being a dick?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cause that could go either way. Like you're aware of it, but then the person on the receiving end, obviously no judgment on your wife. I've never met the woman. But the personality could be like, everything's fine, even though it's not. Or they could be like, you're being a dick. You know
she's
they
could smart. Go, she knows when to like kind of keep it on the low and knows when to say, no, you need to fucking chill out.
Yeah, work something out because whatever that isn't happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. That's healthy.
Yeah. It's interesting that finding a woman that her first language isn't English, but the best communication I've ever had with a woman is with her. It's a trip. And her communication with her family is horrendous. They do not know how to communicate. So where she learned, I don't know. But God bless her.
I wonder what that is. Is it because...
Probably the necessity to communicate because there's just none in her family. She's a quandary because she's just not like her family at all.
Huh.
Like, she couldn't be any different. Like,
what's her birth order in the family? I'm fascinated by birth order.
She's the oldest. She has a younger sister.
Okay. So the oldest of two.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So probably a leader, achiever type mentality, people pleaser, not people pleaser, but kind of a peacemaker.
Kind of. I mean, you know, she's definitely the peacemaker and like the caregiver, you know, and,
looking out for everybody, making sure that everybody has what they need and taken care of, and the middleman between the parents or whatever, sure, and then the younger
mom and dad, yeah, and, I mean, sister, and yeah,
making sure that everything's cool there, and
yeah. And but the communication part is where that I think it just out of it's like where mine comes from, because there was horrible communication in my house too. But I think we just both like realized that it was bad and that we didn't want to communicate that way. Like, yeah, we actually want to communicate. Like, I don't want bullshit.
Right.
Like, you know, don't tell me one thing and do another thing. Like, exactly. I don't want that. You know,
right.
That's not respectful. Let's be respectful of each other.
It's not sustainable. And you see all the flaws in that type of communication. Yeah.
And that being that way has been, it's hard to live that way because people don't live that way. So you know, my 20s were just fucking riddled with heartache. People saying they're going to do things and then they don't. Mm-hmm. You know, like my ex-wife, that shit was hard, you know, going through that, what that was. She ran me through the whole ringer, you know.
How old were you when that happened?
Young. We got married 21.
Oh, wow. That is young.
My first one was 25.
Yeah, I was married at 24. Still too young.
Yeah.
I don't think you should be allowed to be married until you're like 35.
You should definitely not be allowed to have kids until you're older. I really believe that.
Yeah. I don't have any children, so I can't speak to parenthood, but yeah, I agree. Like, those are all some, you're not fully formed yet, you know, in your early 20s. You can't.
Like, one thing I'm super thankful for is I didn't have kids with my ex. No offense.
Yeah, sure.
But, man, that would have been rough. I wasn't ready for that, and it would have ruined my life. Not ruined, but would have changed the course of my life.
Yeah.
And I'm so much more emotionally ready and able to give my kids what they need.
That's great.
You know?
That's great.
I'm too selfish when you're young.
How, what are their ages? You have two boys, right?
Yeah. Just turned 2, the youngest.
Okay.
In May. And then the older one is going to be 5 in November.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. In, 5 in November. Cool. So next year starts school.
So he's next been in spring? School. He's going to a Japanese school.
Okay.
He's been in whatever you call it, preschool for the last 2 years.
Is there a good community for that out here? Like the Japanese early grades?
It was hard to find, but there is a good program, Kodomo no Ie, it's called.
Okay.
And it's all Japanese.
Cool.
And, you know, it costs money.
Yeah.
That's one consideration of moving to Japan. We don't have to pay for school there, and it's really good. But this is cool because it feeds into a charter school. So if he passes the interview, which he's going to have soon, I have full confidence that he will, because his Japanese is crazy good.
Nice.
Then he gets into this charter school, and I won't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
And it's half English, half Japanese.
Okay.
And the only problem is the location of it is in La Cañada. So driving, unless we move there, we're thinking about moving there, but then that's like the most expensive zip code in LA.
It's nice though.
It's beautiful.
It's nice.
But it's
really, is that worse than
$1.2 million minimum to get a 3-bedroom house that's worth anything there.
Okay.
That you don't have to completely redo. I feel like that's
kind of standard actually.
Prices nice are going down though. You can get a house for under $1 million now. That's decent.
That's true. My friend I was telling you about in Altadena, the house was under $1 million. Not by a lot, but
you know, I'm seeing in the 7s, 8s.
I think he got in around like 9.5.
Still too expensive, but
it's a lot of money.
Yeah. I were looking at Japan, the yen is like so weak.
Really?
It's almost gonna be 150. That's half off anything we buy there.
Really?
So like, you know, and then we start looking at apartments. Because it's apartment life there. People don't really buy houses. We can, but apparently houses depreciate there. It's not like here we buy property and
it appreciates. Okay.
It's people don't. Different there. Apartments appreciate.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting. You don't have any equity in it, right?
Yeah. You start looking at the apartments and it's like, damn, it's cheap.
Yeah.
With the yen discount.
The yen discount. It sounds like you get a punch card. Man, like
sign me up, just call me Japanese. I'm ready to go.
Dude, one of my favorite things to do when I'm talking to people is hear gig stories of like craziness that happened. You've been on the road a bit. I'm sure you have some. What are, do you think about like a gig that totally went sideways? What are some funny stories that come to mind? I love hearing these things.
I'm trying to think. I don't know. One night on stage with Cornell, this was pretty crazy. Something that you think is never going to happen. I'm rocking out to the drummer, looking at the drummer, and I'm playing the Jack Cassidy bass, and it's got big fat tuners, like
the lollipops. Yeah, I love the lollipop one electric.
And I, at the same time, I go to turn pretty fast. The guitar player is running across the stage towards me, which I can't see because I'm turning this way, and I catch him in the mouth with the headstock.
Oh man!
Gnarly, dude. Okay. Like blood flying, gnarly. Like
this is me. This is during the show.
Me thinking I just knocked teeth out of his mouth.
Yeah,
you know,
like a bloody nose, broken nose.
Like just, I'm mortified.
Yeah,
and he runs off stage. And comes back with a little bandage on his chin.
Okay.
So he got, it wasn't major, but that was a scary moment on stage.
Did he need stitches or did he just get
two or three, I think, stitches in his chin. Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah.
Who's a guitar player?
Everybody knows Pete Thorne.
Oh, okay.
The Thornado. There were some gnarly moments on stage with Chris, like people jumping on stage and security taking people down.
No, sure.
I kicked one dude off the stage. Like he was on the front of the stage and I just put on his ass and gave him a good 1-2. A couple times in South America, there was one particular show in South America where it was crazy. It's 9,000 people in like a airline hangar, you know, and they're all singing along to like everything, like guitar solos. They're like singing.
Yeah, everything. They know all of it.
And I'm tripping because we have in-ears in and I'm going, why is there reverb on everything? It's like, I can't really hear anything. It's all wet, you know?
Yeah.
So we take a, in the middle of the show, he'd always do acoustic thing. We all go off stage and I go to the monitor guy. I'm like, what the fuck? You know? Yeah. Why do you have reverb in my ears? He's like, it's not reverb, dumbass. It's the crowd. They're singing every line, every guitar solo, every backwards. And I mean, I never seen South America goes off.
Yeah. Well,
like their crowds are in like the best I've ever played for. Yeah. Insane. I remember that striking me. I don't know. Not too much craziness, you know, in the Lucas world. He's just a little crazy. There's been, you know, especially when he was younger, you know, a lot of just kind of shows that just went sideways.
Yeah.
You know, he's
just because he's young and being young,
wild and maybe a little too stoned or whatever, you know.
Cool. So when do you leave for tour? When's you got a tour coming up with him? When does that happen?
I leave Wednesday. We fly to Arkansas for rehearsals.
Okay.
And then we have a show there on the 30th.
Nice. Just a one-off?
No, we get on the bus. We do that show. We go to Mississippi, do a show, and then we chug it to New Mexico.
Okay.
And then we go up. So New Mexico, then we go up to Utah and Colorado and a few, like Iowa. I think there's a Wyoming gig. And then we cut across and do Spokane and Seattle and come down to Oregon. Reading.
Oh, nice.
Reno. I haven't been to Reno in a long time.
I don't think you're missing much. I don't think Reno has changed.
That's right where I grew up. Like Truckee is half an hour up the right hill. There? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we play Monterey and Santa Barbara to end the.
Oh, that's cool.
And I'll be that. That's the 24th is Santa Barbara. So I'll be home the next day. I think she's going to drive the kids up. She gets home on the 17th. So she's going to come up to Monterey and hang out.
Sick.
Yeah.
Sick. Oh man. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. Yeah. Cool. Right. Pleasure, man. Right, thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
All right. That was my talk with Corey McCormick. See what I'm talking about? Like, he dropped some information. Man, it was so cool to just sit there. I had never met him before, and he's just talking about these details from his personal life. They're pretty heavy. Thank you so much to Corey for being so open and honest and just being an open book. Absolutely amazing. Stop by lucasnelson.com. That's the group that Corey is touring with right now. Lucas with a K, L-U-K-A-S Nelson.com. /tour. Check out their tour dates. If they are coming to a city near you, definitely stop by and check them out. Killing Band. If you are enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it. Please feel free to leave a comment about what you think of this show. I'm always interested. Yeah, folks, that's about all I got. That's all I got for this one, I think. I say that like I don't know. I know. I definitely know. That's all I got for this one. I will catch you all on the next one. Thanks for listening. In a minute.